Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 23rd of May, these are our main stories. President Trump says he wants all places of worship in the United States to reopen this weekend, and he's called on state governors to make sure that happens. The British government has confirmed that people arriving in the UK from June the 8th must self-isolate for 2 weeks to help slow the spread of coronavirus. And global health officials have warned that 80 million children are at risk due to the disruption of vaccination programs caused by the pandemic. Also in this podcast, it is hard to believe, but that video game with the bright yellow character Pac-Man is 40 years old. We begin in the United States, where President Trump has urged state governors to immediately reopen places of worship that are closed because of the coronavirus, saying he was now designating them essential services. Speaking to reporters, Mr. Trump threatened to override governors if they didn't follow his wishes, but didn't explain what power he had to do so.
Some governors have deemed liquor stores and abortion clinics as essential, but have left out churches and other houses of worship. It's not right. So I'm correcting this injustice and calling houses of worship essential.
I heard more from our correspondent, Anthony Zercher.
The White House and Donald Trump in particular are feeling pressure from members of the conservative Republican base, evangelical faction of the Republican base, that are really very focused on getting these churches back up and running. And so they're acknowledging and reflecting that in this move. Although you have to understand that when Donald Trump says he's going to override the governors, he really doesn't have the power to do that. He can threaten to cut off funding, perhaps put more pressure rhetorically on them. But it is the governors in the end who are the ones who are going to have the final say on this.
And Donald Trump said that faith leaders are going to make sure that their congregations are safe. Do you think there's a belief from many Americans that that is possible in a confined space with lots of people around?
Well, you know, it's becoming an increasingly partisan issue here in the United States, whether you believe that reopening or not can be done safely in the immediate future. So the CDC has issued guidelines about how churches could conduct their business and their services and not put their congregants at risk. But, you know, these are people gathering together in close proximity. They're singing, they're sharing communion, things like that. And, you know, we've seen in the past early on that church meetings and things have become sources for spreading the virus. So I think there's some very real concern among public health officials and local governors about what this could mean if a lot of people go to churches and some of those people, are unbeknownst perhaps, are carrying the virus.
The British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, has confirmed that from June the 8th, people arriving in Britain will have to self-isolate for 14 days. Ms. Patel said officials would conduct random checks to ensure compliance. Anyone breaching quarantine would face an on-the-spot fine of $1,200 or £1,000. Arrivals from Ireland are exempt, as are lorry drivers, medical staff and French border officials. Ms. Patel said the aim was to avoid travellers causing a second spike now that the transmission rate among residents was falling. The airline association, Airlines UK, said the measure would effectively kill air travel. Our transport correspondent, Tom Burridge, reports.
Over the past 2 weeks, there's been confusion about exactly who would be affected by the government's travel quarantine and about how it would work. The short answer is pretty much everyone will be affected, arriving by air, rail or sea. It means self-isolation at a private residence, including a hotel, for 2 weeks. However, there are exemptions. Medical workers and hauliers won't have to self-isolate. Nor, said the Home Secretary, people arriving from the Republic of Ireland. Ministers say they're keeping an open mind over whether professional sports people might qualify for exemption. Fruit pickers can come in, but won't be able to travel away from where they work. The Home Secretary is Priti Patel.
Now we are past the peak of this virus. We must take steps to guard against imported cases, triggering a resurgence of this deadly disease. And as the transmission rate across the United Kingdom falls and the number of travellers arriving in the UK begins to increase, imported cases could begin to pose a larger and increased threat.
Anyone who flouts the new rules could face a £1,000 fine. The government will review the measure every 3 weeks. It's possible that bilateral agreements with countries with low infection rates, known as air bridges, could be agreed in the future, so that arrivals from certain countries are exempt along with Ireland. Michael O'Leary, the boss of Ryanair, said the quarantine was
bonkers and unimplementable. I mean, the real issue here is the people arriving into the UK, take for example Heathrow and Gatwick, then get on the London Underground or the Gatwick Express to get into London to wherever it is they're supposed to isolate. So the whole purpose of isolation is defeated by the fact that all inbound visitors to UK airports need to use public transport to get to their ultimate destination.
One travel agent told us the new travel restriction would probably be the final nail in his business's coffin. The travel sector has already been battered by the pandemic, and the quarantine will only make any potential recovery much harder.
Tom Burridge. There's been a warning that coronavirus disruption to vaccination programmes will put about 80 million children at risk of catching preventable diseases. UN agencies and the health organisation, the Vaccine Alliance, said it was crucial to resume their work soon. Simon Ponsford reports.
COVID-19 has caused unprecedented problems for health workers trying to carry out life-saving immunisation campaigns. Travel restrictions, delivery delays and lockdowns have jeopardised decades of progress in tackling diseases such as diphtheria, measles and polio. The UN and the Vaccine Alliance say that can't go on. They warn that the lives of millions of children under the age of one are at stake. They want vaccination programmes to start again as a matter of urgency, saying the world must not let the global fight against one disease come at the expense of gains in the battle against others.
Simon Ponsford. There's a growing chorus of international concern over China's plan to introduce a new security law in Hong Kong. The US Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, urged China strongly to reconsider its decision. Barbara Plett-Archer reports from Washington.
The Secretary of State called the proposed legislation disastrous. He said it would be a death knell for the high degree of autonomy that China had promised Hong Kong. Any move to impose the law, he said, would impact Washington's assessment of Hong Kong's special status. The U.S. treats the territory as a separate economic entity from mainland China, which gives it easy trade access. Congress passed legislation last year in response to the mass pro-democracy protests. It requires the State Department to certify annually that Hong Kong has retained enough autonomy to justify the favorable trading terms.
Barbara Plett-Archer. Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, says the legislation will not affect the rights and freedoms of people in the region, but that national security has to be protected.
Hong Kong is a free society. Hong Kong will remain to be a very free society where freedoms of expression, freedom of protest, freedom of journalism will stay, because these are the core values of Hong Kong and are very much protected by the basic law. So I do not expect that protests will end.
But Ted Hui of the Democratic Party in Hong Kong told the BBC that the risks of protesting are now too high.
We can't take it to the streets because we suffered enough of violence from part of the police and brutal crackdowns. And now that they are setting an office in Hong Kong, and which has no accountability to Hong Kong's legislature and to Hong Kong people, they can basically do whatever they want. Now, more and more people are sent to jail, and we don't want to lose any lives of protesters and young people. So it's dangerous, but it's not like they are reluctant to do so.
So what kind of support can pro-democracy activists now expect from outside Hong Kong? Is the United States, for instance, willing to take on China over the new law? Well, Julian Marshall spoke to Evan Maderos, Senior Asia Director at the National Security Council under President Obama, and now a professor at Georgetown University in Washington. Up to now, then, President Trump hasn't taken interest in Hong Kong.
Julian, that's exactly right. I mean, Hong Kong and human rights issues more broadly haven't been on the U.S.-China agenda. To the extent that the Trump administration has had a China policy, it's really had a China trade policy, which focused on reaching a trade deal which was completed in January earlier this year. Other than that, there's been very little interest in Hong Kong, let alone in the situation in Xinjiang, blatant repression of religious and ethnic minorities there. So this interest is new, but it's going to be strategic in the sense that it risks taking the U.S.-China relationship in a very different direction.
The U.S. Secretary of State has been quite outspoken, but do you see a calibration in his response?
I don't see a calibration in the rhetoric yet. His initial response, which was a statement from him as opposed to the spokesman of the State Department, an important distinction, and the language he used was very, very forceful. The question is what can he do beyond words? Because words are nice, but words don't change the situation. And unfortunately, U.S. options are fairly limited. There are a variety of laws that are on the books, but the problem with these laws is they punish Hong Kong, businesses in Hong Kong, consumers in Hong Kong, more than they really punish the mainland. So is the Trump administration, in their desire to have a robust response, going to go ahead and impose those sanctions, even though they wouldn't have any effect on the mainland per se, and certainly wouldn't convince the mainland to withdraw this particular action?
I mean, how much pressure has there been, will there be, do you expect from the U.S. Congress for a more robust response from the White House?
There will be some pressure. I mean, anti-China is a very politically salient issue in the United States right now, and there are a variety of senators, you know, in the Congress, in the Senate in particular, that are interested in running for election in 2024. So there's a strong political motivation to do that. But the calendar to legislate, actually create a new law, is really packed right now, focused on COVID response in America. And there's just not a lot of time. So there's going to be a lot of sound and fury, but whether or not they can actually pass a new bill is going to be a pretty steep challenge. I think the broader issue for the administration is going to be, can they create some kind of international coalition to respond to this? You know, does America have credibility to go to London, to go to Canberra, to go to Tokyo, Seoul, you know, the major democracies that care about these principles and have economic interests in Hong Kong, and get them to send a unified message to China, perhaps including some sanctions?
Evan Madero speaking to the BBC's Julian Marshall. Now to Pakistan, and it was less than a minute from landing at Karachi International Airport. Then the Airbus 320 plane, carrying nearly 100 people on board, plummeted into a residential area of the country's largest city. The airliner hit houses in a narrow street before bursting into flames. Pictures from the scene show blackened houses and charred vehicles destroyed by the explosion. Mohammad Usa Khan lives in Jinnah Gardens, the street in which the plane came down.
When I was at home at that time, I heard a very, very horrible sound. I went outside and I saw there was a huge cloud of black smoke. Quickly, I reached there. It was only this street, my street. Plane was coming suddenly down, coming down, and suddenly it drops over the house. Firstly, it hit the very big wall of a house. And then it dropped down other houses. So four houses were completely covered with this fire. So much fire and smoke was there. And after some time, security came there, army, police, and rescue came. And there was fire brigade stopping the fire.
When you arrived, did you find any survivors?
Yeah.
There were four survivors
on that time, and they were so much wounded. And we took out two people from the houses. They were out of danger.
I spoke to our correspondent, Umair Nagyana, who's in Islamabad.
So far, they've only been able to identify five people out of the dead. And they're saying that the process for the identification of the remaining bodies is underway, and for that, they'll probably be needing the DNA matching, which will take time.
And Umair, it's very early days at the moment, but what do we know about the possible cause of the crash?
The spokesperson from the Civil Aviation Authority, which looks after the aviation matters in the country, has just spoke to the local media, and he has clarified that there has been no statement from the aviation authorities on the causes of the crash as yet, and it will take time. He's saying that they've constituted a committee, which will be an independent committee. It will carry out the investigations, and only that committee would be able to tell us that what actually happened to it. So far, there were a few unconfirmed things, which included the landing gear jammed or the engines of the plane catching fire. But these are all speculations. There is no confirmed report as yet. All we know as of now is that the plane crashed just a few kilometers from the runway as it collided with one of the buildings, which was a taller building relatively in that area. And it is surprising because around the airport, buildings are not allowed to go beyond a certain height. So this also needs to be investigated, for which they are saying that they have already constituted a committee which will look into every aspect of the investigation.
Umar, my understanding is that this Airbus 320 plane was relatively new, about 10 years old. What is the safety record of the airline itself like?
It's not too bad, Nick, because if we look at the crash history of PIA, the last plane that crashed from PIA was a smaller plane, which was an ATR, and the cause was the engine failure. It crashed mid-flight. So besides that, the other plane crashes that have happened in Pakistan all involve the private companies. There have been like two huge plane crashes in Pakistan a few years ago, and they both crashed in Islamabad. And there were no survivors, unfortunately, in both of those crashes. But for the PIA, the record has not been bad.
Umar Nankiana. As we've heard in recent days, the COVID-19 pandemic has had a devastating effect on businesses around the world. The tourism sector has been particularly hard hit. South Africa is into its eighth week of lockdown, with passenger flights grounded and hotels and resorts closed. The industry is reeling, with jobs and livelihoods on the line. Can it survive the pandemic? Vumani Mkhize reports.
The Askari Game Lodge, just an hour away from Johannesburg, is a perfect getaway for tourists. However, at the moment, it's only the animals who are experiencing the scenery. The COVID-19 pandemic has ground South Africa's tourism industry to a halt.
I think we can only carry on for a certain time before things start falling apart.
For Dave Atherston, who's the general manager of Askari Lodge, the situation is becoming untenable. The entire industry is built on human interaction and the movement of people. And without people, you're left with empty dining halls, unoccupied seats, and lodges with no visitors.
In the beginning, in the first couple of weeks, we said, OK, let's get over this and let's get through this. But as we carry on now, the downward spiral of the damage that's going to happen in the tourism sector is going to escalate at a phenomenal rate, putting us in a position where a lot of people will never recover.
Besides the skeleton staff, I'm the only person at this game farm, probably the first visitor in over 7 weeks. It's actually quite a surreal experience. However, for the workers here and the whole South African tourism industry, the COVID-19 pandemic has had a devastating effect. And with cases rising day by day, it's not yet clear when reserves such as this and others around the country can reopen again. One in every 22 working South Africans are employed in the tourism sector, and with one worker supporting between 5 and 6 unemployed dependents, massive tourism job losses will have a devastating effect on the fabric of society.
They pay rent where they stay. They've got children, they have to feed themselves. It's scary. It's like watching a horror movie.
Salome Chungu owns an African-themed guest house in Johannesburg. She's worried tourists may never come back.
International guests, I don't know whether the borders will be open or they will be too scared to even come back, because remember, Africa was the last one to get it. So if they have gone through it, they may not want to have anything to do with us. They've had their share.
The tourism industry contributes around 3% to GDP. And prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, it is one of the few sectors that are showing positive growth in South Africa's recession-hit economy. An interesting development that's taken place during this COVID-induced disruption is the growth of live or virtual safaris.
Comms test, BKD, copy. A number of game farms in the country are offering people from all around the world an opportunity to take in the magic of an African safari from the comfort of their homes. While this won't pay the bills, it might entice visitors to come and take a real game drive once this pandemic is over.
That report was by Vumani Makize in South Africa. Now, news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
Summer 1940. Adolf Hitler was poised to invade Britain. German bombers struck British factories, airfields, towns and cities. Stopping the onslaught took a very special plane. The best fighter plane in the world. The Spitfire. Before a plane could save a country, the people had to build it.
The enemy is making preparations for the invasion of Britain. How are we going to meet and overcome this danger?
The plane would be assembled in the communities it was designed to protect. Towns and villages were new Spitfire factories. The planes built by a fresh generation of young men and women. This is the story of the people who built the plane that won the war. Spitfire, the people's plane. A brand new podcast from the BBC World Service. Just search for Spitfire, the people's plane, wherever you get your podcasts.
Now to Egypt and the death of a young filmmaker, Shadi Habash, who died after drinking hand sanitizer in prison. It's prompted calls by more than 60 human rights organisations for an investigation into the unusual circumstances. In a letter organised by the pressure group PEN America, the organisations are also calling for the release of other artists and writers that they say are unjustly detained in violation of Egyptian and international law. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, has read the letter.
What a powerful letter it is. 60 organizations from around the world questioning the official account. The government says that the death of Shadi Habash, a young filmmaker with his whole life ahead of him, died because he thought that the hand sanitizers in the prison because of COVID-19 was water. And they say they did try to give him medical help. But they question this because there's a number of other suspicious circumstances around it. So I spoke to Julie Trebeau of PEN America, and this is what she told me.
The public prosecutor on May 5th released a report saying that he drank sanitized IQOS as he was thinking it was water. But on May 11th, another report from the Egyptian authorities say that he actually unknowingly drank this water. So the circumstances are totally unclear for his death. And we really think that it was a medical negligence from the prison authority, because what we have also have been reported is his cellmate yell and make noise for hours when he was dying. And the prison authority didn't do nothing until it was too late. So not yet alone that he was illegally in pretrial detention for more than 793 days, so 2 years and 2 months, which is, you know, past the limit of the legal pre-detention time in Egypt.
That report was by Lise Doucette. Now, researchers are beginning a trial of an immunotherapy treatment that could bring hope for people with the most severe form of COVID-19. The patients have extremely low numbers of what are known as T cells, which clear infection from our bodies. The clinical trial is going to evaluate if a drug already proven to boost the number of T cells can help patients recover. Here's our science correspondent, Victoria Gill.
For an unlucky minority, COVID-19 is a debilitating disease and one with no specific treatment. But an examination of blood samples from 60 of the most severely ill patients has revealed a vital clue as to why some have worse symptoms than others. Those samples showed an extremely low number of a specific virus-fighting immune cell called a T-cell. A team from Guy's and St Thomas's Hospital in London is now embarking on a clinical trial testing a new immune-boosting therapy called IL-7. It's already proven to increase the number of T-cells that COVID-19 appears to deplete. While there's still a great deal to learn about how this disease affects our bodies, this experimental treatment could provide some much-needed hope for those it hits the hardest.
Victoria Gill. 40,000 primary schools and nurseries reopened across France last week as the country began lifting its lockdown. Middle schools in most areas began accepting pupils again on Monday. But 100 schools have again closed because of suspected cases of COVID-19. Our Paris correspondent Lucy Williamson has been to one of the towns affected to find out whether people there support the government's plan to get children back into the classroom.
Sens is not a place with a radical image. A market town 2 hours' drive from Paris, sprawled around a Gothic cathedral. But Sens is now known across France as the place that refused to open any of its state primary schools because of 3 suspected cases of coronavirus. All have since tested negative.
Toutes les écoles sont restées fermées.
The town's right-wing mayor, Marie-Louise Faure, says her decision was very popular here. There's too much pressure on parents, she says, because the government has asked each family to decide if their child should return to school.
I think it should either be compulsory or not, because it creates a certain culpability for the parents. If they send their child to school and the child gets sick, they'll feel guilty. If they don't and the child falls behind, they'll feel guilty. If you govern, you need to take the decisions.
The small high street here was full of parents wondering what to do when schools finally reopen here on Monday. Emily runs the local florist. She's planning to keep her 11-year-old son, Valentin, at home next week.
It's complicated because we don't know how it's going to work. My son has some health concerns and I'm reluctant to send him anyway. I feel a bit lost.
Round the corner, Claire comes out of her toy shop to chat to us, her face covered by a pretty patterned mask.
If we had been clearly told you can put your children back to school without danger, we would have put our son in school. But we were not reassured at all. And then, when they closed the schools, we said, well, we were not crazy to keep him at home.
More than 90% of parents here told the mayor they didn't want their children going back into class, even before the schools here were closed. The government has said this decision is voluntary, and many parents are saying no. Since last week, 20% of primary school children in France have returned to class. But the picture across the country is patchy, and those going back to school are often not the ones the government is most worried about.
Our first reason to reopen the school and the primary schools is a social reason. It was a social emergency from my point of view.
France's education minister, Jean-Michel Blanquer, told us that shutting schools had worsened inequality here. But the children returning to class now are often those from wealthier families.
It's true that children of poor families are coming less than the others. The conditions to go to school are quite strict, with very small groups of children, no more than 15, with a lot of measures to have clean places. So that's, of course, the first element of trust.
In Sens, the primary schools have all been disinfected again, the desks separated and the toys put out of reach, ready to open next week. So much that's compulsory for schools, some say, while the attendance of children is not.
That report by Lucy Williamson in France. Friday marked an historic day for video gamers. It was on the 22nd of May 1980 that a new video game featuring a bright yellow, voracious character called Pac-Man appeared in Japan. Yes, the most successful arcade game of all time has turned 40. Our own video gamer, Kate Gregan, reports.
40 years on, the soundtrack of Pac-Man is still familiar to millions around the world. The dot-chomping, ghost-dodging fellow with a big appetite made its debut in gaming arcades in Tokyo in 1980, and soon after took the world by storm. The aim of the game is to steer the yellow character around a maze, while it gobbles down dots and occasionally fruit for extra points, all the while avoiding 4 ghosts named Blinky, Pinky, Inky and Clyde. It was created by game designer Tsuru Iwatani. He came up with the idea when he took a small slice from a pizza, and didn't realise the remainder looked like a wide open mouth. But what makes Pac-Man so special? Elio Sillywood is a video games presenter and journalist.
Pac-Man was one of the first games that almost anybody could pick up and play. These days we look at games and they're designed to be, you know, a little bit more niche. They're designed to appeal to different segments of the gaming audience. But Pac-Man was a game that literally everybody could play.
And it was. Within a year of the game's launch, 100,000 units had been sold and 250 million games were being played every week. But back in 1980, the game wasn't actually called Pac-Man, but rather Puck-Man. But the original title had to be changed just before it launched in the United States, over fears gamers would change the P to an F, which of course would turn it into something that I probably shouldn't say on air.
A careful Kate Gregan there. One of West Africa's best-known musicians, More Kante, has died at the age of 70. The singer and distinguished player of the kora, a West African harp, was from Guinea and he became well-known in clubs across the world during the late 1980s. His song, Yeke Yeke, became a huge hit and was widely remixed. Will Ross assesses his legacy.
In nightclubs across the world, many people found it impossible to stay off the dance floor when Yeke Yeke was played. But More Kante had long been a star back home in West Africa. From a family of griots or revered poets, he came up with his own style of playing the kora, a West African harp, after listening to James Brown records. In Mali, More Kante played guitar and sang in the famous rail band. Later in life, he put his energy into keeping traditional African instruments alive.
Will Ross on the death of one of West Africa's best-known musicians, More Kante, at the age of 70. Well, the president of Guinea, Alpha Conde, said African culture was in mourning. And we'll finish with his song, Yeke Yeke. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.